Control of property is perhaps the most complex of the privacy concerns with genetic information because existing case law contradicts itself. According to Everett, 2003, the courts disagree over whether DNA and genetic code should be the property of individuals who produce it or that of researchers who sequence it. One California Supreme Court case, often referenced by those researchers, is Moore versus Regents of the University of California, in which Moore's removed spleen was used for research without his knowledge. This research led to the discovery of a potentially lucrative cell sequence. The court ruled that Moore had failed to assert ownership rights of his discarded spleen and therefore had no claim to profits made from its research. Some point to this case as precedent, denying individual ownership rights to genetic information, while others argue that it simply denied Moore ownership of his spleen. If you did a double take when you heard that story, you're probably not alone, but apparently privacy, or the invasion of it, can extend not just to your front yard, but also to your internal organs. What is privacy, and why does it matter? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What are your privacy rights when it comes to profiling? How has the Patriot Act affected privacy? How private are the things you read, the things you look up online, and what you watch? Our guest is Alan Rubel, professor in the School of Library and Information Studies and the Legal Studies Program at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
I was thinking about a huge topic privacy is, especially these days where with the internet and so on, it's just it seems as if it comes up all the time, and the number of passwords and information that people can gather about you, it seems to be just exponentially accelerating. Tell us something about privacy itself, the concept, and is it dead?
those are great questions. I'm going to start with just couching my remarks in terms of first, agreeing with you that, yeah, in today's world, with the vastly increasing amount of computer storage capacity and the increasing amount of our lives that we're living in a way in which information can be collected, information about our DNA, as Norman pointed out, information about what we do online, information about what we read, and so forth, just seems more and more accessible. And hence, it looks like privacy issues come up all the time, and that's true. But part of the problem is that, or one of the issues in dealing, in understanding privacy, trying to get our mind around it, is to maybe not try to follow all of the different ways in which our information can be collected, and start to think a little bit about first, what conceptually privacy is, and then second, why we should care, and then maybe some of the things that that come up in internet use or reading privacy and so forth will either not be as big a deal, or we'll be able to sort of understand when we should care and when we shouldn't, and why or why not that? Why or why not?
So let's have a definition of privacy then.
Good.
Is it even possible?
Well, I grew up in a philosophy department. That's my academic training, and I, unlike some people in the who talk about this stuff, think you can. I think that we can do better and worse jobs of figuring out what these concepts are all about. And my view is that one type of privacy, informational privacy, diminishes when other people have the ability to make more particularized or narrow inferences about you. Simple, and that sounds sort of simple enough. A lot of people point out, though, that this includes a vast array of stuff. It includes the ability to be observed, in closed circuit television. It includes the ability to be to have your browsing tracked online.
Yes.
It includes things like DNA, and so even though that's maybe a relatively straightforward definition, it encompasses a lot of stuff. Yeah. And I think that actually more importantly than defining it in that way is to be clear anytime we're talking about three different things. First, the person that we care about, right? So you, Emily, or you, Norman, may have privacy, right? And then there's some domain of information that other people may have information about, that may learn about or know about. And then there's some third person or persons that can learn that information. And I think that when we want to make arguments about when privacy is appropriate, we can't just speak globally about privacy. We have to talk about a particular person, the particular domain, and the other party. I may care a lot about whether, say, the federal government knows certain information about me, or I might care a lot that certain, say, private corporations have about me. And those may be very different, right? I don't care that the federal government knows my income because I pay taxes.
Well, right. It's the law.
And that sounds reasonable to me. Other people may differ, but I don't think it's implausible that that's all right. Whereas, say, every company that wants to sell me something could have access to that information. Well, that starts to become a problem. So I think that in worrying about these things, it's very important to stop and consider who the person, the domain, and the other parties are. That's – if I had to push one thing about privacy conversations, that would be it.
Be the specifics.
Yes. Be careful about when you're making claims about rights or claims or that it's good or that it's bad, you cover those areas.
Well, I would think there's also a kind of fine line between privacy and secrecy, that your right to be private may violate my right to know the truth.
Absolutely. That's very interesting. And some people, there's a woman, Anita Allen, who is a philosopher and a lawyer at University of Pennsylvania, and she's written a lot about this. And she's kind of argued that these different aspects, there are different, you know, modes of privacy, including secrecy, which you might think of as, well, I have secrecy in some domain, say my medical information, if there's no other third person who knows anything about it. That's what a secret is. It's just – it's describing those three parts. And then as you say, and you're exactly right, this is going to create a lot of conflicts because at the same time, in many contexts, it's very important that we do know lots of information about other people. We want to know things about our candidates for political office.
Or a neighbor with a pass, and that's a very controversial area. Absolutely.
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, because, for example, you can get a map of sexual, not just predators, but sexual violators. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're common enough. You could get a map of Madison, Wisconsin that has all of them, you know, dotted on there, and mm-hmm. you discover, oh my gosh, my next door neighbor was arrested for, you know, sex with an underage individual. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then there's also just Google Maps for one thing. I mean, you know, oh, my gosh, you didn't mow your lawn, you know. And, uh-huh. and you have so many bathrooms and bedrooms in your house, which is, I guess, just part of constitutional census data sometimes.
Right. Well, it's certainly part of property records. Yeah. You know, I mean, you can go on.
Find out what's that house worth? Yeah. What did they pay for it? What's the balance on it?
And that is one of those things. Well, both of those cases are ones where it would appear that there's at least a plausible claim that everyone in your community and maybe broader has a strong claim to learn that information. Property records and tax records are very important to ensure that, you know, just because I'm buddies with the mayor or someone else or the city tax assessor, I didn't get a sweet deal. I'm not. I don't know personally any of those people. But
we'll
you know,
check
that would be a big
it.
Deal if you saw that the home I owned was you know, similar to others in the neighborhood.
But and yet under
was
taxed.
Yeah, it was under tax. That's important for government transparency reasons. Absolutely. And so there is that kind of tension that we'll see. And parsing those questions out is difficult, but, you know, it's what
And there's also the issue of confidentiality, I guess, that would come up with privacy, too. You know, my husband's a physician, and I know that a lot of the information that he would get from clients would be protected. Their privacy would be considered top importance. At the same time, if a patient comes and reports beating a child or, you know, doing something, there are these legal things where you have to report it. where that trumps the person's privacy.
Absolutely. And I would even expand on that some. There is an issue now growing with and circling back to the first points you made, there's an issue coming up now about how to deal with patients' information that's increasingly in electronic format and accessible to the patient, him or herself, and shareable with other entities. Now, the HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, has a number of important privacy protections built into it. But here's the thing. Health information is really important. It can be used in employment decisions, insurance decisions, whether or not somebody is going to have some position of responsibility and so forth. And yet, some friends of mine who work in areas of medicine and social media are pointing out that lots of people want to share this information for good reasons. They want to share it online, not necessarily on Facebook, but on patient-oriented websites.
Right.
And it's not always clear that they know or they're fully aware of the potential ramifications. And some people have argued that maybe we ought to paternalistically prevent people from sharing all of their information or all of their genetic information,
kind
for
of a
example.
Problem on the other side, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oversharing.
Oversharing. And you don't – you know, we tend to think people ought to be able to do what they want to do.
With their information.
Yeah, but at the same time, we paternalistically restrict people from doing lots of things. We driving without a seatbelt or not in this state but some places riding a motorcycle without a helmet. And if medical privacy is that big a deal, the restrictions on the ability to share are, you know, something that people might consider. I'm skeptical of that, but that what I think is really neither here nor there.
Would you look at – if you look at sort of the history of this country, would you say that we are having less and less privacy?
I'm going to go back to my being very careful about the three different things that we got to keep in mind, a person, a domain, and other person or persons. In some ways, yes, we have less privacy. I think that's just true. It's certainly the case that information about you and me and Norman and everybody else is more easily accessible with respect to, say, law enforcement agents, right? We have more. We have less privacy about our location from moment to moment if we have cell phones that
if they have latitude on them.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Or GPS units that are built into smartphones. But there are, on the flip side, lots of ways in which we have greater privacy.
Like what? I can think of all the ones. Like, I can think of the fact that somebody could look at my computer hard drive and sort of see the whole history of everything I've ever searched. They can track me on a cell phone. Mm-hmm. You know, if I buy a book on Amazon, it then sends me three recommendations of what it thinks I'm going to like.
Yep.
So how do I have – more privacy than I might have?
In some areas.
Yeah,
for example, you've got a computer. You say you have all this on your hard drive, a whole archive of what you've done. Well, you can password protect that and encrypt that. And that's more secure than a paper archive of the same sort. So in some cases, from the random person coming in to take a look at what's interesting, that's potentially more secure. That's, you know, they might be – you might have greater privacy with respect to the history of your intellectual activities with respect to the random person trying to break into your house than you used to. On the other hand, it's easier to search that stuff, and hence with respect to law enforcement agents, you might have – less. Here's maybe an easier example to get your to sort of explain what I mean. I can do all my banking online, right?
Right.
No one has to know where I have a bank account because I don't have to go in person to make a deposit, right? And they can be deposited directly from my employer. And so the fact that I'm going to do my banking at this moment is harder for the average person on the street to see. Reading privacy. So I'm in a library school. That's my primary appointment. And electronic readers are a big deal now. And so if I were to purchase a book that maybe I didn't want people to know I was reading, I might get it in electronic format.
Can you do that? Can you do that without being traced?
Well, Amazon will know. right?
Right.
But my neighbors might not.
Right.
So I would have more privacy about that with respect to my neighbors than I did before.
Unless you had a brown paper cover on your book or something.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, I suppose the same thing with movies. In other words, they could stop by and check out your mailbox and see what that DVD was you got today. But if you were just downloading it.
Yeah.
Not.
Or instead of going to the theater.
Right.
I mean, you still do that.
Sure.
But now, but much more of our watching habits are online. So there are a few articles in the New York Times or various places about 50 Shades of Grey, right? Which is a sort of a ribald fiction.
Oh, yes.
That's enormously popular, right?
Yes, yes.
And one of the things that people have postulated that drove its popularity is the fact that it exists now that in electronic format. The thing that got it, you know, socially acceptable was the mass use, and that mass use was driven in part because people didn't have to advertise what they were reading on the metro or the bus.
So you're guilty private pleasures or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's a way in which you can have a degree of privacy now that perhaps was more difficult at a different time.
Well, also, you can post comments and evaluations anonymously, which is a kind of disturbing thing where there have been instances at, let's say, a university where a professor who has a rival that's very popular in the classroom can go on one of these Rate My Professor sites and put scathing reviews of his colleague. And because there's no name attached to it, no physical form, there's no monitoring of where that's coming from. Same with the sound-off columns for a lot of the editorials and papers. You can get really blistering remarks with nobody taking responsibility. So in that way, I guess you have more privacy to be offensive.
That's right. That's right. And this is an active area of debate among, legal scholars, philosophers, all sorts of just
too everyone. Much privacy. So
yeah,
we're
whether
saying.
That's that's a case in which privacy does not appear a good thing or justifiable, you know, there's lots of different ways in which those can be monitored. I know that certain blogs that have comment areas are closely cultivated, right? So they have communities of people who are in them, and they have a greater status, and people know them. And then some people have the ability to cut off comments that are unproductive. That's very hard in something like a newspaper that tries to welcome all comers. But it is an area in which we do have more.
Are there other areas where we actually have more privacy?
If not more privacy, you might have more protections for privacy. We can go back to the electronic health record example.
Oh, yes.
If you use an electronic health record system, right? So you have a physician or healthcare provider, an insurer, and all that information is shared electronically. On one hand, it sort of seems like that's a lot of information that can be easily transmitted. On the other hand, paper copies, while they can't be disseminated as broadly as quickly, they can be much more easily accessed and copied and disseminated anonymously.
Right.
So one of the provisions in the stimulus bill included that was passed early in this presidential term included a lot of stuff about electronic health records. And one of the areas of research and commentary and development has been in, well, how do we ensure privacy here? And one way is audit trails, so ways to make sure that anyone who gains access to electronic health records is
– trackable.
Is trackable, right? So while maybe there's this potential to disseminate, there is an enforcement mechanism that can at least keep the incentives very different with respect to the paper. So that's a way in which privacy is protected perhaps more.
In some ways.
Yeah.
The accessibility, although online dissemination could be, you know, what is the term, viral.
That's right. It could be. Yeah. You know, someone famous, and there was some medical information about someone famous that people thought was interesting that could, in fact, go viral. Absolutely. No question. But the hope is that you'd be able to catch the person who originally copied it or accessed it, all the people who
– In the case of a famous person, a public figure, where's the culpability though? I mean, if you're disseminating information about a public figure,
Well, that's a good question. I think, and it's a legal question, so I'll couch this in, you know, I haven't thought about it quite like that. Typically, there is not going to be liability for dissemination of truthful
right,
information.
Right.
There's no libel problem or defamation issue. But presumably, if the electronic health records are actually protected as they should be, then, and you can audit who's accessed them, then there will be violations of HIPAA. You know, for failure to – or failure to comply with the privacy restrictions within that law. So, yeah, if say someone someone anonymously forwarded that information to you and you sent it to Emily and you guys each sent it to two friends and whatnot, you might not be liable, but someone would be. And the hope is that that's enough of a stick to –
Keep that at bay.
Right, exactly. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens. It's probably inevitable that it will happen at some point, and we'll see how well that that theory holds up.
More on the topic of privacy when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest, Alan Rubel, who is telling us about what is privacy and why does it matter. And a big area of privacy, we've seen that we're in some ways more private than we were, despite all this electronic availability of information. But one area that really seems to be at the forefront of people's minds, in fact, we started with an episode having to do with health information and privacy, and particularly something like health surveillance and genome sequencing. How private is a person's genome sequence? Who owns it?
Ownership, that's a tougher question, and I'm going to demur on that. What is occurring now is that it is becoming much less expensive to sequence entire human genomes.
Right.
And there's a phrase that's out there that people use that the $1,000 genome is just around the corner. And the idea is that as computing power and capital investment has increased, the marginal cost of sequencing any particular person's entire genome is dropping rapidly. And this will lead to a lot of people getting their entire genomes sequenced and either using that within some kind of research capacity, so contributing their health information along with their genomic information for research in a variety of ways, and for use in a clinical context. So I might have my genome sequenced, it will remain sequenced, and my physician or could send this information out to a lab to be tested and could come up with correlates for a variety of diseases. Now, if I have that information, if I've paid for it, you know, if I've gotten it done, I might be able to share that in one of the ways that we talked about earlier. You know, I might be able to share it openly with people online, or I might join a site which people are using for this attempt to correlate genomic information with diseases or with something else.
You know, on the face of it, of course, that sounds nice.
It does, sure. And
but...
yeah, it does, absolutely. There's no question about that. But the problem is that we don't really know what it's going to be possible to determine from
the
genome sequencing. Who knows?
Yeah,
so you're almost suggesting that we're losing our ability to be private from ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there's good reason for people to want to share information. You know, perhaps they just want to share. Perhaps they value participating in the research enterprise. Maybe they just don't care. Maybe they share stuff. And yet, the degree to which they can actually say consent to whatever will fall out of that information being shared in a clinical or research context is unclear, because we just don't know what kind of information it will lead to, what sort of correlates we'll discover.
Well, I'm thinking, for example, if somebody sequences my genome, doesn't share all of that information with me, the first thing that happens is they know more about me than I do.
That's true.
In some ways.
Sure.
And so if they were to make that information under the counter somehow available to a potential employer,
right,
boy, you just get a lot of turndowns and you don't know why.
That's right. There are lots of ways in which spreading that information could harm a person. So there is now, in fact, a statute called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which was passed in 2008, I believe, that prohibits employers from discriminating on the basis of genetic information. It also prohibits insurers from denying health insurance coverage on the basis of genetic information. It does not prevent, first, somewhat hidden uses of the information. I mean, it's sometimes
hard to
jack
up the rates, for example.
Well, no, I think even that's not true. But you can deny life insurance.
Right.
You could be a little more diligent in finding other reasons to deny coverage. You could also see it creeping in to employment decisions, even where
sure.
It's not clear what the actual basis of the decision is. And then there's issues of social esteem and social standing and whatnot. If you have a genetic correlate with some disease that people really think badly about, say early onset Alzheimer's or something like that, that could affect your relations with other people in a variety of ways. So that's one of the worries that's out there. But at the same time, you don't want to prevent people from sharing information or participating in research or whatever, because we tend to think people ought to be able to do whatever it is they want to do.
I have noticed that at the UW hospital, every elevator uses the word privacy, because it says, "We respect the privacy of our patients by not talking about them in the elevator," which I think is a little reminder to doctors, don't talk about Mrs. Smith's gallbladder in front of other people.
Absolutely.
When did the law in terms of the whole HIPAA thing come into effect, where it made it much more?
That was in the 90s. 96, yeah. I believe, was HIPAA. And there's always been some laws, right? Confidentiality laws, for example. But that was much more about broad-scale sharing beyond, say, insurers and other people necessary to provide care and funding for care.
And there's signs where it says, stand back in the line if you're at the prescription pharmacy.
Yes,
so that
right.
The person,
yeah.
Respect the privacy of the person in front of you. There's
yes.
ways in which we, I think, are sensitive to the fact that people have a right to be treated for something that they may want to keep private. What about the whole mental health arena? Because I know that certainly in a political campaign with Thomas Eagleton or just others, do we have the right to know about someone's mental health history, or only if they're running for political office?
Good. Well, I wouldn't think that as a general matter we should have access to people's mental health records any more than their any other sort of health records. And it's interesting. So it would be not – it wouldn't be – I think consistent with the Constitution to have some sort of requirement for office that one disclose mental health records.
Right.
But at the same time, it seems that any particular health information that is both momentous, say very, very, very important, and pertains to a candidate for very high office, is the kind of thing that is important enough that might – it's important enough
– that people have a right to know.
That people should know in order to make their vote more legitimate, their decision about what candidates to support for either party nomination or to seat to office. Because we tend to think – or I think it's – there's long – a long history or a long there's a long pedigree of thinking of participation in the political system as a form of consent to government, right? You participate, people either tacitly or explicitly consent to the laws by which they will be governed.
Right.
And consent in any other walk of life is only valid to the extent that it's informed consent, right? You can't consent to a medical procedure if you've been denied important information about that procedure.
Right.
And if the medical information of a candidate is so important that anybody would think it vital for making a decision to support or not support that candidate, one might argue that it would jeopardize the consent to that sort of consent process. Now, that may be I tend to think that's a very limited amount of information. So, for example, Robert Streifer and Julie Fagan, they're on the faculty here at University of Wisconsin. We wrote a paper arguing that in a very limited circumstances, it would be morally required for a candidate for the presidency to disclose certain important information. But it would only be that information that would make it we used a phrase, it's make it very likely that they would not be able to fulfill the basic duties of office. So likely that they're going to die or be utterly incapacitated within the next few years. And that's a very limited, right? That's kind of limited because for the most part, our public officials only have so much capacity to alter how we're governed. And there are, you know, succession rules for most offices. And hence, it would be a very my view is, and I share this with at least a couple other people, is that it would be a very limited number of cases.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you just look at the statistics of 44 presidents and how many of them have died in office –
right.
Of natural causes.
Right.
There would not be too many of those. There are some where the information kind of comes bubbling up after the fact, like JFK with his Addisons.
Yep, yep.
How much difference it made or would have made, who knows.
Right, right.
But it was information that was not generally made available.
Yeah, and that's the thing is there have been a number of cases, and you mentioned Eagleton for one, that information does come to light later that's – that is more worrisome.
One change seems to be that we have much less privacy for public officials than we used to, because I was thinking about how when FDR was in office, apparently the media would really respect his wish to hide the fact that he was in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would photograph him only certain ways and so on. And certainly with JFK, there wasn't the same scrutiny of his extramarital affairs.
Right.
And now it seems as if, you know, you can put topless photos of Kate Middleton on the front. You can do and there's very little privacy for anyone out there in whether it's an entertainer or a politician. It seems as if there are very few restraints on the media.
I think that's absolutely true. Some of those restraints are or historic restraints were sort of gentlemen's agreements. And what gentlemen, you know, tended to be all, you know, a bit of a club that would agree to the terms of, you know, what they will, how they will photograph the president and what they will show and what they won't. That's off the table. So that's no longer the case. And I think in all, that change is at least partially beneficial. You know, the fact that it's not, there's not just agreement that certain things won't be covered. And you do worry, though, that the degree to which everything is taped sort of tends to make very small stuff much more important.
Sure,
part of the,
sure.
But
– well,
know,
and
I,
with giant zoom lenses and things that
yes.
can pick up on what someone says when they think they weren't being recorded, privacy certainly with increased technology – is harder to obtain.
That's right. It's much harder to completely restrict other people's access. That's certainly the case. I don't think there's any.
There's always room for a lawsuit, though. I mean, in Kate Middleton's case, for example, either to block this dissemination or to get damages.
Right.
After
there
the
is
fact.
There is that. That's true. Although that's some people would say a sort of a weak a weak proxy for actual
you
protection.
You can sue. You won't necessarily succeed.
Yeah, well, you sue. The damage is already done, that kind of thing.
What about our privacy to have our own home to ourselves, a sort of lack of search and seizure? How has that changed over the years?
Well, it's interesting. There is kind of, in terms of just the cases, the legal cases, it's something of a mixed bag. There's been some pushback on uses of electronic monitoring devices for at least in terms of people's homes. So, for example, in the last decade, I can't remember exactly the year, or about 10 years ago, there was a case called U.S. v. Kello that involved a use of a thermal imaging device to find a house or to establish that a house was radiating a great deal more heat than all of its neighbors and, you know, just along one wall. And this was used to find a marijuana growing operation.
Oh.
And yeah, and
how resourceful.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And the Supreme Court determined that that was a violation of Fourth Amendment rights and in part because it was a person's home and in part because it was a particularly rare device. Like most people don't walk around with thermal imaging devices. That was in contravention of some case law that had established that other sorts of electronic monitoring, other sorts of technologically enhanced monitoring was okay. So use of an airplane to fly over someone's land to find a marijuana growing operation or use of a helicopter and advanced photography and mapping equipment to find Clean Water Act violations, that kind of thing, had been typically considered within the purview, covered by the
Fourth Amendment. Does that mean if the person doing the searching or the surveillance is in a public place, such as the overhead airspace or
yes.
In the case of poor Kate, maybe a mile away with a telephoto lens of some kind, does that mean that they can do that with impunity?
Well, there's going to be – I'll go back to the first thing I said. There's it's important to keep track of the person, the domain of privacy and the other persons involved. So here we're talking about police. We're talking about state actors, right? And state actors sort of changes the equation, right? They are subject to the Fourth Amendment. You and I are not. Well, I mean, I'm – partly. Well, I guess. But mostly that's police. It's also other sorts of state actors. And they can generally stand, for the most part, if they're in a place they're typically allowed to be and just looking, then yeah, they can – they're generally in compliance with the Fourth Amendment, except in certain technologically enhanced cases like the thermal imaging device.
Right, right.
And now after the U.S. v. Jones case, placing a – GPS monitor on an automobile to track it. That's even though most of that activity took place within public space, it was considered a search under the Fourth Amendment, and hence had to have a warrant.
Kind of like a wiretap.
Kind of like a wiretap. That's right. Except. Yeah, this was partly involved the trespass theory. That's a little into the legal weeds, of it. But the point was just that Emily asked, what about the home? And in some ways, there's been some restrictions. There's a case about dog sniffing around the property that's
right.
up before the Supreme Court. Now we'll see how that bears out. So I would say a mixed bag.
More on privacy when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Alan Rubel, and we are talking about privacy. It's a really fascinating topic because I was thinking about the different times where, you know, you want to protect the right of someone to have their privacy. At the same time, there's the public's right to know and to be protected from harm. For example, let's say I go to my doctor and I say that I have HIV/AIDS and that I'm having sex with multiple partners and not telling them. Or let's say that I'm deaf and I'm using the relay system so somebody else has to say what I'm saying on the phone, and I'm plotting a murder and I'm talking about that, and that employee of that company is actually bound not to tell that I'm about to commit a murder. There's these places where it seems like it gets really fuzzy.
It does, absolutely. And this is a place where I think it's helpful to go back to why we care about privacy in the first place, and or, you know, what justifies information disclosure in certain cases. So I think the HIV example is really interesting. There are a variety of reporting requirements that healthcare providers and others have to give, typically to state public health agencies, individualized information about people who have been diagnosed with certain conditions. HIV/AIDS is one of them, and this is coordinated by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the federal agency that deals with public health. But it is typically a state level reporting requirement. So you report to, if you're a physician and a patient has one of these conditions, you report to either a state public health agency, a city public health agency, or whoever has created this requirement. And there's a variety of conditions that and it makes complete sense that at least some of these conditions would be reportable. So tuberculosis was the first one of these really to take root in the U.S. in New York at the end of the 19th century.
So if somebody has tuberculosis and it's discovered by, say, a physician, it has to be reported.
That's right. It's reported. And there are follow-ups. There's the ability to monitor, determine whether it's multi-drug resistant. And, you know, it's largely treatable, but if not treatable, it's disastrous, it's infectious. And tuberculosis is a public health triumph of the 20th century, and part of that has to do with these reporting requirements. You know who has it. HIV/AIDS is another one. This was controversial for many years. A number of states tried to have reporting requirements that were based on numbers rather than names. It became very difficult to actually implement, and that is now a required reportable condition.
It's more controversial for AIDS than tuberculosis because it implies an alternative lifestyle, as many people would
yeah,
think.
I think there's stigmatization. Yeah, I think stigmatization was a big part of it. And one of the reasons, there's been much more buy-in from various communities that were more likely to have to have members who are HIV positive. So particularly men who have sex with men and HIV drug users and their political advocates and allies and other people bought in to the importance of reporting, and that was an important way in which the reporting became much more palatable. And this has historically been the case. So you've gotten more – so for example, occupational health and disease reporting became much more politically palatable in the middle part of the 20th century, reporting people who got cancers on the job or injuries on the job once you had buy-in from labor organizations, for example. They were able to say, okay, yes, this is the kind of thing that – in total benefits us. But it gets a little more dicey, right? So infectious diseases, that sounds right. Why? Because you're –
public good.
Yeah, and you're keeping it secret is likely to harm somebody else.
Right.
It gets a little fishier. It gets a little more difficult when you start talking about non-infectious diseases. So the New York City Department of Public Health has recently begun requiring that laboratories that do blood tests for New York City residents report elevated blood glucose levels. So it's an A1C test, which is a very good test for longer horizon blood glucose levels and stability. And diabetes is a problem. It's a very big problem in New York, particularly in certain boroughs or in certain areas that are poor and have tend to have less worse nutrition. And the idea is that if they can have mandatory reporting of diabetes, maybe that will be one way in which they can get a grip on the problem. But it's a weird case because one's keeping one's diabetes secret is very different from the one keeping one's tuberculosis secret. You're not going to hurt somebody else. You're not going to infect somebody else.
Right.
Moreover, it's not clear exactly what the follow-ups would be. Right. It's not like diabetes is imminently treatable.
Right.
And it's not like there's actually a clear plan in the city of New York to follow up directly with people to get their diabetes under control and perhaps, either lifestyle or pharmaceutical.
So it's not
other,
exactly actionable, in other
it's
words.
Not. That's right. And that's weird. Right. So this is where I think it's important to step back and think about why we care about privacy and why we care about the reporting in the first case. If we care about just a public good, as you put it, and that's I think sort of the right direction, it's going to matter how we understand public good, right? You might benefit some people who have diabetes, and the overall average or aggregate health of the people in New York might increase, but not because people are getting infected, but just because the person, the single person is. On the other hand, you might think of the public good as, protecting people from infectious disease or protecting people from diseases they might catch from someone else. And that in that case, tuberculosis might fit,
for sure,
but diabetes might not. So that's sort of the tension here. And I've argued that diabetes doesn't really look like the kind of thing that is the proper scope. Other people disagree. Obviously, New York does. But
what about legal issues and legal confidentiality and the public good? This is an argument I sometimes have with my brother, who's an attorney, because I don't think I could be an attorney, because if somebody came to me as a client, I understand that they need a good lawyer who will hear the whole story, but then not necessarily present that whole story in a court. But what about the lawyer who hears his client, his or her client, say some things that would lead him to believe that this person should not be let free? But they go into court and they argue in a way that is going to get that person off. How is that privacy of that lawyer-client relationship kind of bump up against the public good?
Right. I'm going to be very careful about what I say first, because I'm a member of the Wisconsin Bar, though inactive. And, I've looked at these and I can't remember exactly the language or the phrasing of the obligations. But there are requirements that lawyers protect against clear threats. And they aren't allowed to mislead in court. Right? You can't actually lie about something in court. So if you know certain facts, you can't misrepresent them. You can skirt them. You don't necessarily have to say anything. But that's and how do I justify that? Well, the arguments tend to go back to something about the adversary system, and that the lawyer is there as a way to ensure that a person who is within the legal system actually getting the right process. And you can't turn the best process possible. Yeah, right, that's right. The best process possible
may not mean justice.
Right, right. And you can't invert that relationship and still ensure that that they would have that proper process.
So in the final analysis, if we look at the Patriot Act, how has that affected privacy?
Good. There's a lot of different aspects of it, and it's changed over time. So one of the big provisions was a national security letter provision that was particularly problematic, and that was changed in the reauthorization. I actually think I'm going to change directions a little bit and emphasize one thing that we haven't really gotten to, there were a couple of provisions, Section 213 and 215, that allowed for delayed notice of warrants, so intrusions into one's home or other places where one would need a, where a police officer would need a warrant, and gag orders that would prevent people from talking about this stuff. And these – and my worries about those were kind of ancillary or a little bit different than the privacy worries. So the privacy worries are there. There are warrant requirements for searches. There's exceptions and all of that. And what those provisions of the Act did that I thought was problematic was that they obscured what was going on the ground. So people could be searched without their knowledge. They could and it could be the case that they could not communicate about the search afterwards, right? So those were worrisome because they prevented a mechanism for correcting problems, and they circumvented a mechanism for people just understanding what's going on in their lives, right? Even if you're – well, if you've been searched, it's important – it's important that you're searched. It's also important that you know it, right? It's important that we have facts. We have knowledge of what's been done to us. And that's the worry I had there. And yeah, there's the privacy worries, but it goes a little beyond that. And that's treating people with, you know, enough respect to give them the information that's important for them to know what's going on in their lives.
Another privacy issue that comes up is in the case of profiling.
Right. Yeah. Profiling is a very big issue, and it has a number of different components. You know, some people – there's a guy, Fred Schauer, who's a professor at University of Virginia Law School, has argued that, look, all a police investigation is some sort of profiling. You're making judgments about certain facts and deciding how to best examine a case. The worry, the one that's more in the press and that you hear about is racial or ethnic profiling. And this is another one of those cases where it's very hard to get your head around, because a lot of what might be, there are cases of overt profiling. There's cases of, you know, subconscious profiling, and, you know, how do you control for that? And, you know, this is like my comments about the Patriot Act, one of the places where I think that government transparency is particularly important. So there are several states that require police officers to maintain records of the race and ethnicity of people that they stop in traffic stops and what the outcomes of those stops are. And Wisconsin had a law like that. It was repealed. And my worry there is that that's another one of those things that you know, these are government actors, and it's important to know, you know, what's going on. And, you know, I tend to be confident that most police officers are not engaging in illegitimate profiling. Perhaps some are, perhaps some aren't. Some may be doing things unconsciously, and maybe they're not at all, right? But that's an important question. And without data on this, we can't figure it out. So that bothered me that law was repealed. And, you know, not because I think necessarily that there's lots of racial profiling going on. I don't know. But I can't decide that without data. So that's, you know, I think one of those areas that will continue to play out for a few years.
Our guest has been Alan Rubel. Thanks for joining us and giving us some of your insights into privacy today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.